93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
You know what I consider the sort of reigning kind of theme of pop music now? It's all these, like, you know, empowerment anthems, like all of these songs, you know, that are like, I'm the best, I don't need anyone, you know, hear me roar, etc. Like, it's the fact that that is now the sort of party line being spit out by our pop stars and that we are receiving it kind of without questioning it, I find very troubling.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. My guest today is Amanda Petrusich, one of my favorite music writers and an all-around good pal. You might know her from The New Yorker, The Village Voice, Spin, Rolling Stone. She's written for everybody. Today we're going to be talking about something I never thought I would actually feel nostalgia for, which is the indie snob. You don't see the indie snob anymore. This archetype doesn't seem to exist. And for a long time, I would have welcomed that extinction. But lately, I've been feeling weirdly, like I said, nostalgic for that. And Amanda and I had a conversation about that that I think was really interesting, and I'm excited to share it with you guys. Before we get to that, though, I want to welcome a new sponsor, and that is Harry's. And you might know Harry's as a company that offers a good shave at a good price. And that seems to be a hard thing to find. I know as a guy who has to shave like every couple of days that you either have like the really cheap razors that like tear up your skin or you have to like spend an arm and a leg to get anything good. But this Harry stuff, I've been using it and it's been great. And let me say again that I am a hairy dude. I need to shave a lot and I need a good razor, and Harry's has been really fantastic. If you guys want to get started with Harry's, and I recommend that you do, there's this thing called the Starter Set, which they call the Truman, and it's a great option for new customers, and it's an amazing deal. Like, for just $15, you get a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Yes, the Germans have engineered these razors, so you know they're good. If you enter the promo code ROCK when you go to Harry's website, and again, that's harrys.com, H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. If you enter in the promo code ROCK, you will get $5 off the Truman set. So really, there's no excuse for you not to try this. So again, go to harrys.com, enter in the promo code ROCK, and get $5 off your introductory set. And not only will you get a great razor set, you will be supporting the podcast. So everybody wins in that scenario. So, again, my guest this week is Amanda Petrusich, and whenever Amanda's on, it's always a great conversation. I had her on a couple of months ago, and I had her on this time, and it's funny because we actually were going to talk about a different topic. I had a different topic planned when I called her up and invited her on the podcast, but we got sidetracked on this thing talking about the indie snob. Now, you're probably familiar with this archetype. You know, it's the person who wears like the horn-rimmed glasses, that has the impeccable record collection, and has lots of opinions on what records you should buy. And usually they're really obscure records. You know, this person used to be a staple of music culture. In a way, it was the person that you would want to impress if you were just getting into music. But in the past several years, you know, underground music culture has shifted, and now we're at a point where indie rock seems almost like a non-entity, and it's pop music that controls the conversation, not just in the mainstream, but also in the underground. And in the process of that, the old indie snob person seems to have disappeared. And, you know, I'm a person, I have all kinds of tastes. I like things that are critically acclaimed. I like things that are sort of not critically acclaimed, if you want to put it that way. And there was a long time where I reacted against the indie snob straw man, if you will. But now that this person seems to have faded away, I kind of miss this person, and I miss what they represent. I could go into this more, but I think I just want to play you this conversation, because I think Amanda and I touch on a lot of things in here that I've heard other music fans talk about of late, and hopefully it'll stimulate some conversation with you and your friends. So here's my conversation with Amanda Petrusich. Well, Amanda, it's always great to have you on the podcast. I'm glad you could come on again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about right now, but I want to start with this piece you recently wrote for The New Yorker about other music.
Sure.
And Other Music is a famous record store in New York that recently closed. Is it closed now?
It is. I believe Saturday was its last day, last Saturday.
Okay, and we're recording this in late June, so it closed at the end of June. And normally, we wouldn't talk about the closing of a New York record store on this podcast, but in your piece, you talk about the closing of this store in a larger context, and it's an interesting context to me, and I wanted to talk about it. I just wanted to read this section of the piece. And before I read this, I just want to compliment you for an excellent use of the word obtruse in this piece, by the way.
Thank you very much.
That is a great word for if you're writing for The New Yorker.
It's true.
I know you're writing for a great audience when I read that. But this was, I think, the pertinent paragraph, or the most pertinent that I pulled out. And you were talking about, just to set this up, you talk about, shopping at this store when you were a teenager and being intimidated by the people there by the employees, because they were so smart and they knew so much about music. Mm-hmm. But that, how that was also sort of attractive to you because you wanted to be like one of those people in a way. And you write this: "To anyone born after me, this probably sounds like a hideously snobbish scene. As I've learned teaching music criticism to New York University students, subsequent generations have since adopted a lovely do-you magnanimity when it comes to musical taste. Part of this might have to do with their instinctively inclusive temperaments. They have come of age in an era in which intolerance is forcefully policed. And part of it may also have to do with the breakdown of genre, or at least as it once existed in the record bins. There are no record bins anymore, no little plastic signposts signifying content, broadcasting a set of principles, musical or otherwise. Genre itself, or more specifically genre affiliation as a means of self-identification, feels like another end hovering in the atmosphere this week. No one is asked to choose one affiliation at the expense of another. Instead, it is perfectly normal, even expected, that a person might have a little bit of everything stacked up in her digital library. The idea of other music, in quotes, as it was conceived in 1995, is unknowable now." And the thrust of your piece, and correct me if I'm wrong, is sort of talking about this store in the context of music being this sort of oppositional thing, that it's not, that now, that the sort of tribalism that maybe you and I grew up with, like when we were coming up in the 90s,
right,
it has gone away. I'm wondering, however, if maybe instead of the tribalism ending, if it's just shifted a bit. And I just want to preface this by saying that I don't totally endorse the premise of this question, but I don't not endorse it either.
Right.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. I'm wondering if we've moved into an era where, it's less about genres being against each other than it is about sort of popularity being pitted against unpopularity. And if now the sort of culture, the constituencies that we may have in previous generations associated with underground culture, if now those people have sort of dropped their cynicism about mainstream culture and have totally just kind of gone in on what's popular, whereas the stuff that's unpopular feels marginalized and doesn't kind of have that cachet that it once did, that in a way, because it's unpopular, it's considered unimportant. Does any of that resonate for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting way to think about it. I don't necessarily think our takes are even at odds exactly. It is funny. I mean, I think about this, like, what is the kind of creation of this odd middle ground that wasn't there before, which is, as you said, sort of music that's commercially unpopular and sort of critically uncool, and just kind of exists in this odd sort of liminal space where no one pays attention to it. Or even bands, like I think of a band like the Foo Fighters that are commercially hugely successful, but critics sort of don't pay much attention to. They don't really have any cultural currency or cachet. They just sort of exist, on this odd plane. And I don't know, the extent to which, I mean, for me, that the name itself, Other Music, was so, I feel like at some point kind of in the store's, you know, history and sort of arc that kind of quite how confrontational that name was. I feel like it was sort of lost, right? Like the meaning itself behind it, we stopped thinking about, in part because to me it started to seem like it didn't really make sense anymore. Like we weren't kind of drawing that line in the sand. But I mean, I don't know. Did you grow up with that sort of tribalism? I did, certainly. It was like you were, you know, you liked this kind of music or you didn't, and like there weren't, you know, it wasn't, we weren't so open-minded and kind of kind to each other.
Oh, yeah.
Our tastes.
Yeah, I definitely, I mean, I wrote my, you know, the book I wrote is about tribalism, basically,
right,
you know,
right.
And yeah, I definitely grew up with that. And just to be clear, like this store, Other Music, it was founded in 1995, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
And again, just to give context for people who aren't familiar with the store, this was sort of like, I've never been to the store myself, but based on what I've read about it, because there have been several sort of eulogies for it recently, it was sort of like the prototypical record store, like the store that you go into and you're going to find like a lot of obscure stuff that you're not going to necessarily find at a lot of different stores, especially these days, if there even is a record store in your town. Sort of staff with people that know tons of esoterica about people like Captain Beefheart and Arthur Russell and sort of cult figures. Am I right? Does that sound about right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that kind of curation, for lack of a better word, you know, you had the sense that you could go into Other Music and any record you picked up would be, and this may have been a myth, I'm sure this was part of the mythology of the store, was, you know, any record you picked up would be interesting. But like, if you were a certain kind of person, you know, who was interested in perhaps a more challenging listening experience or in sort of seeking out something that was in opposition to the mainstream or to what a lot of people liked. If you were a weirdo, you could go in the store and, like, pick up anything and there would maybe be something there for you. It would be worth your time, at least. There was a sense that it had all been vetted. I mean, like, aggressively vetted by this team of experts, you know, these people who knew more than you about what was cool. I mean, that was, for me as a kid, at least, kind of how I read that. And I think that, you know, when I evoke my students there, my poor students who are always getting dragged into these pieces against their will, you know, they don't, like, to them, that's not an exciting idea. Like, I think when I explained that to them, like, oh, it was terrifying, you know, and you felt like you were the biggest idiot on earth, and, like, here was this crew who could tell you something about, you know, what it meant to be cool. Like, they're like, well, you know, I'm sorry, I'm going to use, I'm about to curse, I will try to keep my mouth shut. You know, to them, they're like, no, you know, that sounds terrible. Like, we don't want that, that's ridiculous.
Right.
But for me, it was, you know, it was like a hugely sort of formative experience. And yeah, I mean, that was the vibe of the store, was, you know, come in here, like sort of come into the fold. We will barely tolerate your presence, but you will leave with something that could, you know, blow your mind.
Right. And that is something that I definitely grew up with. And I feel like in the 90s, if you came of age in that era, that was sort of glamorized in a way, that sort of posturing, you know, that this idea that you're going to seek things out because they're unpopular, you know, that is part of the appeal, because popular appeal sort of signifies lack of intelligence or lack of taste, you know, that sort of old dichotomy that if it's popular, it must be bad. If it's not popular, it must be good. You know, that was something I was definitely raised on. And to circle back to that question, that I don't, again, totally endorse the premise of, but I also don't not endorse it. I'm sort of in the middle, and I guess I'm hoping that you can help me figure this out. You know, I feel like in music culture, there's been a very clear shift away from that idea. You know, this sort of straw man music snob, you know, and I guess it's not just a straw man. It's something that actually existed maybe in the form of Other Music or the people that would work there. That person is sort of the opposite of cool now. That person is sort of discredited all the time. And now the message is that you shouldn't be cynical about mainstream culture, and that, in fact, if you are, that says something bad about you as a person, that you are somehow not open-minded enough to understand that sort of thing. And, you know, it's interesting because I feel like when I was a writer in my 20s, that I spent a lot of time sort of thinking about that, again, that straw man music snob, and like writing a lot of pieces refuting that. Like, I would defend a lot of bands that were not critically acclaimed or that were not considered hip or cool or whatever. But now I have a certain nostalgia for that snob. I feel like that we've kind of lost, we've kind of gone out of whack the other way now, in a sense. Like I kind of wish there were more of those people around, because I just feel like that doesn't exist anymore, or those that kind of thinking has been totally marginalized. I mean, does that make sense at all to you? Does that resonate?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, and I think I'm with you there. And, that, you know, and I wonder, like, all right, well, what was advantageous about that way of thinking? Like, there are ways in which it was plainly sort of stupid and exclusionary and kind of snobbish and very white and very male. And, you know, all the things we kind of deride it for now, or all the reasons why it's dismissed now. But I do think there was something useful and something sort of lovely and beautiful about the sense of being an adolescent and not really feeling like you fit in with, like, the popular kids in your school or sort of whatever, you know, your particular zeitgeist was, of feeling like, this is not me, this sort of doesn't reflect how I feel about the world. And then having this kind of thing you could disappear into, this sort of group of weirdos that, you know, had its own hierarchy in a way, but I do think was reflective of that feeling, of that sort of outsider feeling. It was nice for me to have that to sort of escape to, or to show up to a place like Other Music, you know, and it sort of reflected or validated my feelings about the world, which was, all right, I'm a little weird, you know, or I'm into this stuff that other people don't really like, or, like, I don't really, you know, I don't want to do these things that my peers are doing. It doesn't sound fun to me. I'd rather do this. It was nice to have a place that felt like a kind of clubhouse for, you know, for people like me. And maybe I'm being too, I don't know, generous, but I think there was something kind of nice about that. And I also think, for me, you know, as a someone who grew up to become a music critic, like, internalizing that sense of discernment early on, that, like, you know, music is a thing we should sort of hold to a high standard. Music is this, you know, beautiful, intense, very serious art, and we should ask big questions of it, and we should be snobby about it, and we should have big demands, and, you know, it should push the boundaries in one way or another, and it should excite and frighten us. And I feel like, in some ways, you know, and I'm a fan of pop music, and I'm a fan of, you know, taking pop music seriously and writing about it seriously, but I do wonder sometimes if we've sort of loosened our grip on those questions, those sort of big critical questions that were so important, you know, for me when I was a kid, that I feel like now in our sort of spirit of kind of niceness and open-mindedness, we have maybe lost some of those, I don't know, some of that, you know, questioning. I don't know. I mean, is that sort of where you're thinking?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, I'm going to make this disclaimer right away that it's, you know, there are problems with judging people in terms of generations, that we're all individuals and you don't want to be too reductive,
sure,
when you describe people. That being said, I will say that the difference that I feel between, like, how I felt when I was, like, 22 and I see people who are 22 now, is I feel like there is a lack of cynicism about mainstream culture.
Yeah.
That when I was growing up, that there, like, I remember when The Simpsons came on and how liberating it was to watch that show, because it was the first time that I can remember. And this was also true of, like, things like David Letterman and to some degree, like, Nirvana and things like that. But it was the first time I remember the sort of, like, vacuousness of mainstream culture being acknowledged. Like,
right.
The Simpsons would make fun of bad TV shows.
Yeah.
You know, they would make fun of, like, sort of stuffy people, like politicians, or, you know, sort of hypocritical people at school or in the church or whatever. And I had always sensed those things as, like, an adolescent, you know, like, as a budding sort of cynic, you know, as a kid.
Yeah.
But it was never acknowledged. It was always sort of these stupid sitcoms and, like, very, you know, very flashy pop music. Like, it was like Milli Vanilli records. It was Saved by the Bell. You know, it was all of those things. So for someone to say, like, no, this really is bullshit, this is stupid, and
yeah,
you're and if you think it's stupid, then you're smart, and
right,
and we're communicating to you. Like, all these other people might take it at face value, but if you know that it's stupid, then you're one of us. Like,
right.
I felt that as a kid, and that meant so much to me. And my sense is that, at least when I look at how culture is discussed now, that when we talk about TV, when we talk about pop music, when we talk about, you know, blockbuster films, the reverence for these things is so deep and profound that the part of me that's still that 13-year-old kid is sort of, he feels even more alienated, than
right.
he did then.
Because
it's like, why are we taking these things so seriously? Like, or can't there at least be a, like, even if we are going to take these things seriously, which is, I think, like you say, it's valid. I like reading good criticism of pop music and good criticism of film and TV. That's all great. But like, can there also be a space for like the cynic, for the, the snob in quotes, someone who can say like, this is bullshit. I hate this stuff. I mean, I made this joke on Twitter a little while ago, but like I'd love to read an oral history of the period. This was like maybe a couple years ago when it was sort of illegal to make fun of Taylor Swift. Like when, music writers would go insane on social media anytime anything mildly disparaging was written about Taylor Swift. And it's like, it's not like I hate Taylor Swift, but there ought to be room to make fun of her because there's a lot to make fun of there. You can, she's not perfect. To me, that's part of the job description of a pop star is that they're there to be made fun of. They're also, they can also be transcendent. They can also be life-changing. They can create great art, but they're also on some level ridiculous and silly and stupid. And there should be room for both of those things. And I don't know. I feel like I'm ranting here for a long time.
No, I agree. I think a lot of what you're saying makes sense. I think that's true of Beyonce, too, another artist that sort of seems to exist beyond reproach. And in fact, if you were to sort of make a kind of gentle, do some gentle ribbing in her direction, I think you would very quickly be sort of branded as, a hideous person. I think it's, it's true. And I think there are things when I consider, and I've written about this a little bit, when I consider the sort of reigning kind of theme of pop music now, it's all these like, empowerment anthems that are very sort of self-serious and also self-aggrandizing in a way that I think like, God, is this really cool? Like all of these songs, that are like, I'm the best, I don't need anyone, hear me roar, etc. Like it's the fact that that is now the sort of party line being spit out by our pop stars and that we are receiving it kind of without questioning it, I find very troubling. I mean, even beyond the idea of just, making fun of these people a little bit because what they do is, in fact, as silly as it is important and serious. I worry that some of that stuff is slipping through the cracks now, sort of, with our kind of enthusiasm for poptimism or the sort of idea of poptimism or, taking pop music seriously, that we are sort of, losing something there, too. Because I do think, as you say, there's a lot to make fun of in a kind of friendly and fun way. And then I think there are things that are really worthy of real critique. I mean, pop music is often where the sort of zeitgeist emerges, or at least where it's kind of crystallized into, all right, this is what, everybody's thinking now. This is what we're all sort of internalizing. This is what we're living. It can be a really useful tool for distilling that and, criticizing it or at least asking questions of it. And I worry if we're not doing that or we're not allowed to do that or it's considered mean to do that now somehow.
Well, yeah, even you said, you said that in a very nice way where you're saying like, well, we can do friendly, good-natured ribbing of them. We can also have mean people. Like I would like to see someone who is just an asshole about pop music writing in a major sphere just as a counterpoint, even if it was someone I would read and think, oh, I don't agree with any of this, it would still be nice to see. And I feel like if we're in this internet culture where you have infinite media outlets, that there ought to be room for that, and it seems like there's more conformity, with that than more diversity, at least in terms of like it's more diverse, thankfully, in terms of the kinds of people who are writing about music, that it's not just white men anymore, that you have women and you have writers of color, and that's changed the discourse, and that's a great thing. But the diversity of opinion, I think, sometimes seems reduced a little bit.
I mean, and part of it, I think, is this sort of nonstop conversation we're all embroiled in, that is the internet, of course, is the engine that runs it, where, I'm sure you felt this in your own writing, too. You write something nice about a musician that you like or a record that you like, and the response is often, like, very polite and calm, and people read your piece, and perhaps they make a thoughtful comment on it, or, perhaps they just go about their day. You write something that is remotely sort of, like, poking the bruise a little bit of something you maybe think isn't so great. And it requires a lot of energy, I think, on behalf of the writer or critic to then sort of receive responses to that. I mean, I write infrequently at this point in my career about bands that I dislike. But, you know, every once in a while I'll publish a piece, you know, usually in the New Yorker about, like, I wrote a piece about Coldplay a few months back that was, I think, hopefully a sort of fair kind of questioning of how dumb their lyrics were. And, you know, and I can sort of get behind the sentiment of their newest record of sort of life is beautiful and isn't this amazing and et cetera, et cetera. But the piece was sort of saying, like, is there not maybe a more sophisticated way to, you know, talk about these ideas or talk about the sort of reinvention in a life? This is really corny, you know, this is super sentimental and, like, God, I mean, I still get emails and tweets and, you know, responses that are just people really upset. And I do think for us as critics now, you know, in this sort of world we live in now, you have to be ready to deal with that stuff. But it can be exhausting. And I wonder sometimes if critics shy away from publishing those sorts of pieces in part because you just don't want to deal with it, right? I don't know if you've ever felt that way in your career. Maybe I've talked to writers who have expressed a similar sort of like, ugh. I got to deal with this for, you know, 6 months.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think at this point, it's so ingrained that you're censoring yourself even if you aren't aware of it, you know.
Right.
And on some level, that is not entirely a bad thing. I mean, I think because I know there are, you know, a million and one ombudsmen out there who are, you know, amateur, you know, sort of media critics. We're going to jump on anything that might be out of line. I mean, it does make me more careful with what I write. Mm-hmm. But again, yeah, there is also the flip side where it's also less interesting in a
right.
lot of ways if
yeah.
you're going to do that. I mean, you know, we were talking before about this in terms of generations. Do you feel like it is a generational thing, like a generational shift, or is it a product of the internet? You know, sort of the internet opinion economy now, where if you do voice an opinion that isn't part of the herd, that you'll either be attacked or you'll be pushed down the page because you don't have the likes and the retweets and the favorites. That, you know, it's because I do feel like part of this is that just of the way these conversations take place, that they're so easy to quantify now, like the interest level in it.
Right.
Like, I always think about when, like, the Village Voice did a cover story on the Replacements in, like, 1985, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the Replacements, I don't think were even on, they weren't even on Sire at that point. So they were, like, a fairly, you know, they weren't a famous band at all. And not that they were ever hugely famous, but they were on the cover. And it was like the worst selling cover, I think, of that year. It was like the least popular cover of that year.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, they could still make a choice to do that because they thought that was a great band and that people should know about it. That you could make the decision, those kinds of, that you could decide that something was important even if it wasn't popular. Whereas I feel like
right.
now, to say that something is important without also a huge sort of commercial audience behind it,
mm-hmm.
is really hard to do, and it's hard to justify. I feel like your audience maybe won't even accept that, you know.
Right.
And it does kind of circle back to this elitism that people were reacting against, I think, for a long time. That, you know, well, who are you to say that this is great? Like, who are you to say that the Replacements are great? We love Paula Abdul. You know,
right.
and
yeah.
that was something that was rejected in a previous era. But now I think that is, I feel like that's maybe the norm, you know, that like, oh yeah, of course this pop star is more important than this sort of niche artist because they have a huge audience.
Right.
And that's how we define importance now.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I think the backlash against snobbishness has been so vast and powerful that, again, the sort of pendulum has maybe swung too far in another direction. I don't know. I mean, it also kind of raises questions about, you know, what is the role of the critic right now? And, you know, what are we doing? Are we sort of, you know, are we here to kind of validate popular opinion or explain to people, all right, this is hugely popular and this is why? I don't know. I mean, that sounds boring to me, but maybe that, you know, maybe that is sort of what the critic should be doing right now. I don't know. It's so complicated. It feels like in some ways we live in a cultural moment where the sort of signal to noise ratio is so skewed. I mean, there's so much music available so quickly and cheaply, if not for free, that it seems like, oh, theoretically we should need critics more than ever. You know, we need someone to sort of say, like, all right, well, this is worth your time and this isn't. But in some ways I feel like the kind of I don't know, the sort of mentality out on the streets is like, don't tell me what to do. There's kind of petulance. People are very sort of confident in their own tastes and proclivities now. They don't really want them challenged. So I think it's a funny time. It's a funny time to be writing critically about music because you want to consider what your audience wants and needs. You want to serve that, but it's at a kind of strange odds with the job itself, right? Or the job itself, at least as we knew it growing up when we did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and look, I hate this word, and I feel like people are going to shut up this podcast as soon as I say it, but poptimism, the irony of poptimism to me is that it does seem to be hastening the end of music criticism, because if it's going to be a situation where music critics are writing more articulate versions of opinions that you can get for free on social media, there's not really a reason for them to exist. You know, if music critics aren't bringing something to the table that people don't already know or feel like they can get elsewhere, there's just really no reason for them to be read, you know, because it's like, you know, like if I want to hear about how great Beyonce is, I don't really need to read your think piece. You know, I don't have to spend 3,000 words. That's like a long time to read your 3,000 word think piece. I can just search for Beyonce's name on Twitter and there's tons of people talking about how great she is, and they have pictures of her concerts, and you know, and those tweets might be funnier than your think piece, and more insightful, and they're quicker to read. I'm not saying that like it should be purely elitism or snobbery. To me, it's about the sort of loss of balance. I just feel like the check that maybe the media had on mainstream culture, you know, the sort of bullshit detector to say like, no, this is terrible, or like, no, like your empowerment anthem is empty because you're already hugely successful. So like, of course you're powerful, you know? Like, I mean, I will say too, that for me, and again, I'm going to show my age, but like I always have a soft spot for art that affiliates with losers, you know, or the people that aren't successful, that, you know, that that can't pull it together, you know. And I guess, you know, like, if we were going to look for like a metaphor for this idea, it would be like the Ethan Hawke character in Reality Bites, you know, like that guy smoking cigarettes on the couch. And as much as I can make fun of that archetype, I also have a weakness for it, because I think there is a nobility to that, because I had it ingrained in me, I guess, when I was a certain age. But I feel like that idea that if you aren't successful, that you also don't matter. You know, that idea, which seems to be prevalent now in culture.
Absolutely.
That bothers me.
It's so interesting. I think of like a song like Radiohead's Creep or even Beck's Loser. I mean, these are really explicit and popular examples, but there was a moment in time in which those sentiments were expressed and received, you know, and it's, God, can you imagine here? I can't remember the last pop song that, you know, had some sort of admission of weakness in it, right? Or admission of, I don't know, frailty or self-doubt.
I mean, I feel like Lady Gaga waved that for a while, you know, because I feel like she was at least a little, I mean, her songs are very kind of triumphant and like, you know, like we're going to triumph over adversity. But at least there was like a, you know, like I'm associating with freaks kind of mentality.
Right. Yeah. Thing. Like an off-screen enemy. Yeah. I get that.
But
yeah,
I don't,
that's interesting.
But I don't know. I mean, I always can't decide about whether this is something this is just the way it is, or if it's a pendulum swing and we're going to swing back to that. I guess I feel like the way, again, like the internet media is set up, that it's going to be hard. It's going to be harder than ever, I guess, for sort of marginal stuff to get an audience.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard. I mean, and I think I'm sure this is still sort of being untangled by media critics and people who know more about this than I do, but I mean, you do feel that sense that for a story or piece of criticism to get any traction, it either has to kind of confirm what everybody else already thought, or it has to challenge it in a way that feels sort of confrontational and crazy. There's kind of no middle ground, right, for like thoughtful kind of reason through questioning of a thing that, you know, maybe isn't making some sort of bold declaration or qualitative declaration, but is sort of saying like, well, what about this? And yeah, I feel like those kinds of pieces get lost so quickly now, you know, because nobody tweets them. No one cares. I don't know. It's a strange moment.
Yeah, it's just, it's just so easy, I think, for positivity to drown out negativity. And again, I don't want to complain about that. I mean, it's kind of weird, I guess, in a way to argue that social media is too positive, because I feel like there's a lot of complaining, obviously, that goes on. But I don't know. I just feel like these, and it's not just music either. I mean, I think that this is also true of popular TV shows. It's popular. It's true of like big movies. I mean, like obviously in cinema, the sort of big tentpole franchises have kind of swallowed up everything else, at least on a studio level. And if you're going to make a movie, a smaller movie, chances are it won't even get into a theater. It's going to be on VOD. You know, with television, I mean, television in a way, it's funny because I feel like, you know, there was a lot of heat on television in the 2000s where, you know, this was sort of considered the important cultural media. And in part because it was easy to pinpoint the important TV shows. Like you could agree that it was The Sopranos, The Wire, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, maybe a couple after that, but those were sort of the big ones. And now TV is looking more and more like pop music, where it's so diffuse. There's so much of it that to find those central narratives is really difficult, or becoming more difficult. It's like Game of Thrones, and you know, there are pockets that care about Transparent, pockets that care about Orange is the New Black, but you know, it's harder to figure that out. So I don't know. I guess we're all doomed, I guess, is what we're trying to say here.
At least you and I are a couple of grumps.
Yeah. We just want more cynicism. We're looking for, you know, that seems like a crazy thing to ask for, but
Well, we can talk about other things, surely, but I also wonder, and this is an honest question, like, I wonder when the last time you read something, or when, you know, the last time most people read something that really changed their mind. Like, I wonder sometimes if we have lost our ability to kind of be open sort of readers of criticism, or open kind of consumers of that stuff. You know, I think we see this kind of reiterated in politics endlessly, where it's this sort of feedback loop. You know, people make up their minds really early on, and then you've got this whole year of sort of yammering on both sides, but nobody really, you know, that the kind of myth of the undecided voter that, you know, everybody sort of knows right away, we've kind of picked our affiliation, and there's no, you know, no one's going back. And I wonder, you know, if there was a TV show, I remember doing this as a kid, there were records that I liked, and then I would read reviews of them that were like, ah, this is actually really derivative, or this is kind of, you know, silly, or this is a sort of whatever. And I would really go home and think, like, God, I'm so stupid, you know, which is not, and I would have my mind changed, which I realize sounds terrible, and it sounds like I was sort of bullied or talked out of something that I genuinely
Me too.
Liked.
That happened to me all the time. It would ruin the record for me, and I was like, why did I read this?
Yeah, you know, yes. Or I would think, like, how could I be so silly as to think, like, this, you know, you two were a good band. Like, clearly they're the worst band, you know, I mean, and I realize that that was maybe not good either, but I do sort of miss the power, now I'm going to sound power hungry, but I do sort of miss the power that criticism had when I was a kid, where I really did, like, I would really change, like, a kind of persuasively argued, sort of intelligent piece of criticism had the ability to change my mind, or at least get me to kind of question my taste, or to sort of interrogate my taste in a way that I feel like sounds sort of mean and bullying and terrible and no fun, but was actually really good and sort of formative for me as a listener, and I think changed the way, you know, how I sort of grew up hearing music. I don't know. I don't know if that's even possible anymore. I don't know if someone would read a piece of, you know, that kind of challenged Beyonce or challenged Taylor Swift and would actually be able to have their mind changed. I don't know if we read that way anymore. I don't know. I mean, it's just a thing that is on my mind sometimes. I wonder about.
Yeah, you know, whenever I start talking about stuff like this, I'm keenly aware of my age, and I'm like, okay, how does someone who's younger view these things? Because, yeah, I'm the same way, and I would say that one of the reasons why that happened to me, like when I was younger, and I would, you know, maybe feel a certain way about a record, and then I'd read the review and I'd feel stupid because I liked it or something. It was because maybe that was the only review I read, you know, like I didn't have access to other reviews. And, you know, that's a weird thing to romanticize now, to say like, oh, I only had one magazine. It's like, well, why is that better? It's obviously better to have multiple voices and opinions and all that stuff. And, yeah, it is better on paper, but there is also sort of weird side effects that are weirdly beneficial when you don't have as much access this stuff. I mean, like, you know, you mentioned this in your New Yorker piece that, you know, you teach music criticism at New York University, which, by the way, I gotta say, like, if you're going to New York University, that's not a cheap school to go to.
No.
I just wonder, like, what their parents think when they're taking a music criticism class. It's like, are you kidding me? Like,
I know.
You want to write
$50
record reviews for the Village Voice? Like, are you insane?
It's true. It is insane, and I think about that often. I mean, I hope the idea is that, you know, well, NYU, of course, is not a trade school, so it's not, you know, we're sort of contextualizing the, you know, the idea of criticism. I hope what my students take away from my class is, you know, an ability to kind of express, you know, express themselves on the page critically, to sort of be critical and curious consumers of culture. You know, hopefully these skills that they can translate beyond the very sad career of music criticism in 2016. I hope, I mean, that's my hope, that they're learning some sort of fundamental, basic, you know, critical thinking skills that can be applied elsewhere, because God knows this job is a tough one right now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but like, what do they say about this kind of stuff? I mean, are they, you know, I mean, you said before that in terms of taste, that they have sort of like a, you know, you do you mentality, that it's like, well, I'm not going to be judgmental, and which I think on balance is a great thing. I mean, I mean,
it really is.
It's great.
And I meant that line in the piece where I think it's really lovely. And the fact that they have grown up to be, you know, intolerant of intolerance, I think is wonderful. I mean, God, I can't think of anything better, sort of, you know, in terms of where the culture could be headed. I do wonder sometimes about this idea of, and I say this again sort of without really, I'm not really on either side of this debate at the moment, but, you know, this idea of like, well, if I like something, then that's it. Sort of, that means it's good, or it's good for me. You know, and in some ways I think like, oh, well, that's a really wonderful way to listen to music, and you're never second-guessing your taste, and you're really sort of following your heart or whatever. But then there are other times where I think just because you like it doesn't always mean it's good. And I realize, you know, good in the context of the sentence is a very wide-open and slippery term. But that idea to kind of trust your taste so much, I don't know. Maybe I'm talking myself into a strange corner here. But I think there are things in life that feel good, or that we want to do, or that, you know, you eat the whole bag of potato chips and it's a great time while it's happening. But it doesn't necessarily mean the potato chips were good for you, or the most sort of nutritive choice, or that, you know, they're not going to come, you're not going to come to regret that choice later. I wonder, like, when we stop sort of applying that same idea to our kind of, you know, taste in music or other sort of cultural objects, that this idea that, like, well, if I like it, it must be good or good for me, is a funny thing. And I feel that sort of in the air now, right? It's like,
yeah.
I don't know. And I don't really know how I feel about it yet. It's a thing I've noticed that I feel like wasn't quite so present when I was a kid. And so therefore could be some sort of, very anecdotal, obviously, but could be some sort of generational shift. I don't know.
Well, you know, and I said this before that, you know, in my writing career, I've sort of taken my own shots at elitism and sort of defended artists that I felt like were unfairly treated under that sort of thought idea. You know, like, okay, I've written defenses of the Counting Crows and of Stone Temple Pilots and bands like that.
Yeah.
That are just, you know, not cool at all, you know, and would be, you know, in a way, I'm a poptimist for rock music,
it's,
you know,
because
I defend a lot of rock music that is sort of, you know, passe or ultra in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can't be a hypocrite here and say like, well, you know, if you're defending this, then that's wrong. I mean, I see a lot of value in that. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm nostalgic for is, I still want those elitists on that wall, you know? I want them on,
yeah.
I still want someone to be there, even if it's just someone that I can react against sometimes. I still think that there is a value in someone who's going to say, no, like, this is, like, I care about this, I care about authenticity, you know, that outmoded word. I care about sort of not selling out. I care about, you know, these sort of ideas that, we've just sort of taken as a given, like, don't matter anymore. And I don't know, maybe that's just my, someone might listen to this and say like, well, that's the most rancid form of 90s nostalgia that there is. and maybe it is, you know, maybe that's a valid point. But I don't know. I feel like at some point, if there isn't that, then this conversation kind of loses a lot of meaning, I think, in a way. You know,
yeah.
or it loses something, it loses some kind of common thread that we can all be a part of, because at some point it just becomes fan clubs.
Right. Yeah. No, you know? Absolutely. I agree. I mean, I think we both, it's like I want that guy in the room. I don't want him to be the only guy in the room.
Right.
I want that guy with his arms crossed and like a sour look on his face, judging everything, you know, by very high standards of what he considers a kind of artistic purity.
And
yeah,
it is a he, and it's usually a he, as you just said. It's usually some guy who's balding and has bad glasses and doesn't dress very well. Yeah, kind of mean, and like you don't really like that guy, but
no, he's horrible.
But at the same time, you know he's kind of intelligent and he's funny. And you never agree with him, but you're like, you know what? Okay, I'm glad he's there, because it makes things a little more interesting when that guy's still in the room.
He's heard everything. He has a million records. He holds everyone to very high standards. I mean, it's, you know, he knows when you're ripping someone else off. It's I think it's an important voice in the chorus of voices, you know, that should be talking about this stuff for sure.
So, like, we're defending the indie snob, I think.
I know. How did we get here, Stephen? I feel like neither of us would be known for this kind of attitude. But, here we are.
I know. It is funny, you know, and, we're running out of time here. I did not expect to talk this long about this topic, but I do think, I miss the indie snob. I feel like the indie snob has taken, the prototypical strawman indie snob, which has been sort of reviled, I think, for the last 15 years or so. I want them to come back. Like, where have you gone, indie snob?
Yeah,
you know,
come back.
Come back. We miss you.
Yeah.
Well, Amanda, I know you got to get going. So thank you so much for talking.
Oh, God, it was such a pleasure.
It's always, and, you know, like, this conversation ended up in a weird place, but I feel like we both feel it's right to be in a weird place right now with this.
It is. It's a weird time. A weird time to be alive.
All right, Amanda. Well, hey, thanks again.
Thank you, Stephen. Take care.
All right, that was Amanda Petrosich, my good friend and a great writer. I recommend that you check out her books, by the way, especially Do Not Sell at Any Price. That's her latest book, and It Still Moves, which is a fabulous book as well. Again, I want to thank our sponsor for this episode, which was Harry's. And again, we have that great offer for you if you want to get that Truman set with all of your sort of introductory shaving gear. If you go to the website, harrys.com, and enter in the promo code ROCK, you get $5 off on that. So you definitely want to do that. And you also let them know that you listen to this podcast, which will make them want to sponsor more episodes. And that's a great thing for us. Thank you guys so much for listening. This has been a really fun episode, and I look forward to chatting with you guys next week.